This is MSO News Sports. I'm Rick Moore, and we're talking now with our basketball insider, Mike Grenier, once again. And Mike, welcome back. How are you doing?
We're good. We're good. The weather's warming up, and we hope so are the Celtics.
We're getting there. Let's talk about the Celtics right away. Last time we talked, we started with an overall view of the playoffs. We're going to do that in reverse order this time, if it's okay with you.
Of course.
All right. I want to ask you right off the bat, it occurs to me that several times when we do these interviews, I start off with my opinion and my view.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you see with this the most recent game? What's your views on it?
I'd say that, I think you and I were texting, and you mentioned we're focused, and I think it started with that, with the Boston Celtics being focused in Game 3 on the road. I would call it a must game, because they certainly didn't want to be down 2-1 with playing on the road again Monday night, tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty much a must game. And right from the get-go, I mean, obviously Miami only scored 12 points in the first quarter. The Celtics defense was up on them like they hadn't been up on them the previous game when Miami had 23 open three-pointers. Miami found it much more difficult. It was like running through mud because the Celtics were impeding them at various spots on the floor. Tyler Hero couldn't get it going. Adebayo couldn't get it going. Their top players couldn't get it going. And, you know, the Celtics took a decided advantage in the first quarter and just kept the pressure. What I liked is that they kept the pressure on them throughout all four quarters.
And I think a lot of that had to do with the rotation, Mike, because, Peyton Pritchard, even Luke Kornet got into the game early. Pritchard was into the game relatively early. Sam Hauser was into the game early. And they just brought an energy that the Celtics just kept up at that high level.
Right, and not only that, Rick, that's a good point, but they got the playing time. But unlike the previous game where Pritchard played 20 minutes and didn't take a single shot, this time both Pritchard and Hauser, and, of course, Horford, he's an experienced guy. He knows exactly what the situation is. Both Pritchard and Hauser were not afraid to shoot.
Right.
You know, I mean, the bench contributed far more in Game 3 than they did in Game 2 when they only scored 12 points. So, yeah, you could tell the coaching staff must have met and decided, all right, we have to change our approach for Game 3. We can't show Miami the same old thing. So the other thing I thought, Rick, was early in the game, they forced Miami to take a lot of time off the clock on the inbounds passes. In other words, like they were inbounding the ball, and the Celtics were pressuring, like not a full-court press, but delaying their offense. And Miami couldn't get into its offense until, 11 or 12 seconds left on the clock. So,
I don't remember seeing that this season, because at times it did look like a full-court press.
Yeah, it was. It was. And I just thought that by putting pressure on them early, I don't think Miami expected that. And it took them a lot longer to get into their offense. And they obviously didn't get good shots in the first quarter because they only scored 12 points. And they also committed a bunch of turnovers. So everything went Boston's way. I love the fact that the Celtics led by 27 and 29 even early in the fourth quarter. And they wouldn't let Miami back into it. You know, Miami didn't make any kind of run to get it down to 12 or 10 where you start to worry a little bit. So it was all around. It was a complete game. Defensively in particular, they didn't score a whole lot of points. Boston, as a matter of fact, only scored, 44 points, 43 points in the second half. I think it was like 61-something at halftime. So they didn't score a whole lot of points, but they didn't let Miami score a whole lot of points either. So it was a well-rounded victory, offensively, defensively. Allowing Miami only 84 points is a tremendous accomplishment, I think,
All right, let me go with the names. Let's start with Porzingis.
Night and day difference, obviously, between Game 2 when he shot 1-for-9 and Game 3 when I think he scored Boston's first 8 points.
Right.
So, therefore, there was a decided difference in his approach. He was far more aggressive than he had been in Game 1. They changed things up where he got post-up moves and he took it to the basket, hit a couple threes. That always seems to get him going when he hits a couple threes early in the game. Sometimes we cringe, right, Rick, at some of the because he takes a Caitlin Clark type three out by the logo. But if a couple of them go in, then he seems to go inside and operate. So that's a good sign. So we hope that continues. But a major difference when he posts up inside, especially against that Miami zone. And I even saw Drew Holiday post in at the foul line a couple of times just to take the pressure off Tatum and Jaylen Brown outside. They would shovel the ball to Drew Holiday at the foul line, and he wasn't necessarily shooting, but the defense had to slide towards him, and he was making the proper passes, as he always does. So, you know, they just had a really good game plan, I thought, a good scheme against Miami, which always has a good scheme itself. So a complete victory. Obviously, if they can get another one in Miami tonight, up 3-1, coming back to Boston, you're looking at the possibility of ending this series early, which the Celtics would love to do, because the Knicks are ahead 3-1. The Indiana Pacers are ahead 3-1. The last thing Boston wants to do is have this drawn out to a 6- or 7-game series while other teams are resting.
All right, before we talk about the Jays, what about D. White?
D. White, it's funny. He's got kind of an odd, I think, the way he has come on. He seems to start off slow. Doesn't take many shots. He's very involved in the defense. His defense is superb. But then he seems to hit a spark on offense, whether it's the second quarter or the third quarter, where he'll get a rash of points, 8 or 9 or 10 points in a row. And at the end of the night, you look, he's got 18, 19, 20, 21 points, and he's done a great job. So he's such a value. I'm glad you mentioned him, Rick. I don't think we talk about him long enough or enough times, because frequently enough, because he is such a huge factor. And the fact that he's improved so much in a year's time, you know, if they're going to win a championship, they're going to need Derek White to play at the highest level. And the highest level of his career has been this season and right now in the playoffs. So, you know, he's been so solid. You can always count on him playing a good defense. He might miss a couple threes early, but then he seems to get hot. You know, he's got a nice three-point shot. He's very smooth. You could tell he's worked on it endlessly. I gotta say, though, Rick, one thing we need to mention is we always, you know, we critique Jaylen Brown for missing free throws, but Tatum, who's, you know, sometimes gets a triple-double even in the playoffs, he missed 4 free throws.
Right, yep.
4 free throws, which was so... He missed 2 in a row once, you know, after getting fouled on a shot attempt, and then he missed another couple free throws down the stretch, and you say, oh, my God, he's like an 87, 85% free throw shooter, 83%, and he's missing free throws, and, you know, he's got to break that habit, because in close games, he tends to take it to the basket a lot and gets fouled more than anybody else on the Celtics team, so therefore, he's an excellent free throw shooter. I don't know, maybe it was just a glitch in that game.
Go back for a minute. Did Larry Bird ever miss 4 free throws in 1 game?
You know, I bet you if we had to look through the history of Larry Bird's games, at some point, he probably did. We just don't remember, because you mentioned the word focused early on, Rick, and you mentioned to me even last night on the, you know, and Larry Bird was so focused in every game. I mean, I still have that image of getting to the Garden many times for the playoffs or regular season, and he'd be running around the corridor, the old Boston Garden, you know, where there was no air conditioning. That's how he would get ready for the games. He would run on the concrete level above the court, getting ready for the game, regular season and playoffs. So he had a focus. He had a determination. He was all business. And, you know, there's no reason for Tatum to miss free throw, because he's a very smooth player, a smooth shooter, and he does work in his game. I mean, he wants to be one of the great players. He is one of the great players in the league. He wants to be considered among the best, and he wants to win a title as much as Larry Bird did. So, you know, let's hope that he just smooths out that free throw.
Okay, and finally, Jaylen Brown, your comments on his play, because the one thing I'm looking at when they play the way they can play as a team, and I think it really stood out on Sunday, was the seamlessness of the substitution. It was seamless.
Yeah.
There's a lot of moving parts in that team. In other words, there are different strengths that each of the other players among the guys out there knows about his teammates.
Yeah. And you know what? It was so seamless, and that's a good word to use, because I think at one point when the non-starters were out there and leading by 25, 26, I didn't want them to come out, right?
Yeah.
That's really seamless. When you say, oh, my goodness, they're taking out Hauser and Pritchard and Clifford and bringing back, you know, Brown and Derek White or whoever was sitting for a while, you're going, the bench is playing so great, why bring the starters back in? But, you know, they do. You know, obviously that's the right move because you want to continue to attack Miami. But, you know, that's how seamless it was. The bench came through big time the other night. In game 3, and you got to hope that Mazzulla still has that faith in them whether it's just game four tonight, but throughout the playoffs. Because, you know, obviously if they win this series, on paper, the next series should be easier because they're going to play the winner of the Orlando-Cleveland series. And Lord knows who that's going to be because it's 2-2 and Cleveland has dominated at home and Orlando's dominated at home in Orlando to get it tied. So we don't know who's going to come out of that series. So, but technically, either of those teams is easier than playing Miami.
We are recording this before the Monday night game. And so obviously a lot of listeners are going to check this out beyond that afterwards. But tell me about Spoelstra and what do you expect, win or lose on Monday night? What do you expect some of the things that he might try to do?
Well, you know, he's known for doing the unexpected. So I it's hard to forecast because he might come out in the zone. He might come out in the full court press. He might change defenses in the middle of the first quarter. You don't know who he's going to use on offense. Obviously, Jimmy Butler's not available. I like the rookie, Jacquees, out of UCLA. He's had a great year, and he's been utilized a lot in the playoffs. You know, he's grasping at straws a little bit because of the injury factor. Terry Rozier has been out. He would be another huge factor if he were healthy. So with Spoelstra, he kind of like, you could tell he probably goes into a dark room with film and comes up with something different every game and discusses it with his staff because you never know what he's going to do. You know he's going to throw, the element of surprise is part of his demeanor, is part of his DNA, his coaching DNA. So you just don't know what he's going to do, but he's so competitive and they play to the final minute. So he definitely wants to win at home. He does not want to go to Boston down 3-1 after beating the Celtics last year. So I kind of really don't know what to say on that because he's just such a surprise. That's what makes him a great coach, I think, is that the element of surprise. He'll throw anything at you, and it's usually effective. I think he's a student of the game. I really do. I believe he's a really outstanding student of the game.
Well, that's a great answer for what do you expect from Spoelstra. That's you expect the unexpected. And then,
correct.
Yeah, you described it. Yeah, he is. And talk about an intense person. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he is. He is. And, you know, whenever a Miami team, when you trot him out there with a guy like Adebayo, who's outstanding, Tyler Hero had a great 14 assists in the Miami win in Game 2 in Boston to go with like 20 points or 21 points or whatever it was. Those two guys alone make them a threat. And when they start sprinkling in, you know, if Duncan Robinson starts hitting the three or, you know, Kevin Love, you know, who's been playing for 17, 18 years, if he comes in and starts hitting the three, then the Celtics have to start guarding those people because it's going to be a close game. So, you know, he's got some really good players. Even as, even as average players, you know, step up against the Celtics. So, therefore, they're still a dangerous team in my mind because, you know, Boston, if the series gets tied tonight, Monday night, as we're talking, if it's 2-2 going back to Boston, then the pressure, I think, shifts right back to the Celtics having to win at home at the Garden in a couple of days.
Okay, your impressions on the rest of the NBA because the Lakers live for another day. OKC, as you predicted, they keep rolling. Embiid is really upset with the Knicks fans invading the Wells Fargo. So what's your impressions around the league?
Well, you know what? I'm going to throw one name out at you, and it's kind of a local ties name, Jalen Brunson.
Mm-hmm.
Could he be the mayor of New York right now, Rick?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I had the pleasure of watching Bernard King play when he was at his peak with the Knicks and he played the Celtics. And in one playoff game, I believe, you know, he had a 46-point playoff game, which stood for 40-something years until Jalen Brunson scored, was it 47, I believe, yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
So Brunson is already in the annals of Knicks history as the highest scoring one-game playoff game with 47. He's come such a long way from a guy who was a second-round pick and out of Villanova, and unbelievable his skill level, the way he takes over a team. And, you know, yesterday he shot 18 for 34. He was like something like 14 for 15 at the foul line. He controls the flow of that team. He scores in volume. He gets his teammates involved. He's got the leadership skills of a Jason Tatum, right? He's clearly the leader of that team. And, you know, if Julius Randle was playing, he's out for the year with that shoulder surgery, they would be a threat, you know, against the Celtics in the Eastern Conference Finals. So, you know, I start with him only because, of course, Jalen Brunson's father is Rick Brunson. out of Salem High School, who, you know, won a state championship in 1990. I saw him score. He went 16 for 24 for 42 points in the state semifinals at the Boston Garden against Bishop Fee in a 68-56 win. I just remember to this day how great he was as a high school player and also at Temple University. And he didn't get much playing time in the NBA, but he still put in 8 or 9 seasons as a fringe player. Obviously, his son Jalen is much further along and has become a real star under the Klieg lights, the bright lights of Broadway. It's a hard place to be a star because there's so much critiquing that goes on in New York City.
Okay, wait a minute. Wait a minute. You just used a word that I'll bet you anybody under the age of whatever has no idea what you just said, Klieg lights. That is awesome. I love it.
The bright lights of Broadway have been on him for a little while now, and boy, has he come through. And I know, yeah. And B, you mentioned he scored 51 in the previous game. Yesterday, he struggled a little bit. He got so frustrated that he popped Brunson one time, and Brunson objected. It should have been a foul. It probably should have been a technical foul, actually, or a flagrant foul on Embiid. And Jalen Brunson went over to talk to the official and didn't get much word edgewise because his father, Rick Brunson, waved him off the court. He said, get into this timeout here.
You know, I want to ask you about that.
The father still influences the son in that case. And I think, you know, Jalen Brunson made a good point. It was kind of a cheap shot by Embiid out of frustration, and the officials ignored it, which it should not have been ignored.
I want to ask you about that.
As great as Embiid is, you know, he's frustrated right now. They're down 3-1, and, you know, there isn't much left in the tank there, you know?
Your relationship with these local athletes is something that I really enjoy listening to, and when you talk about Ricky Brunson, we covered him as well at WESX.
Yes.
But what you just said there, the father telling the son, cool it. Tell me about, if you can, what that means, what you think of the legacy of Rick Brunson to Jalen Brunson, because, as you say, Jalen Brunson is surpassing Rick as a pro or as a basketball player, but obviously there's some real upbringing there from father to son.
Oh, yeah. Rick took, he recognized Jalen's talent early on, and I personally saw that because Jalen Brunson used to go to the Lawrence Boys Club ABA camp, which stands for Academic and Basketball Awareness, which was run by my brother-in-law, Steve Kelly, who worked at the Boys Club in Lawrence for 56 years. And it was a great camp, and Rick Brunson used to come from Salem and bring Jalen, I think from the age of around 5 or 6 or 7, and I believe he went for 6 or 7 consecutive years as a little kid. So he developed a love for basketball by going to camps like that. And we knew that in high school in the Chicago area, he was a rising star player. And, of course, good enough to land a scholarship at Villanova. They won national championships there. So he was on the fast track. But his beginnings, his roots were right around here, 2 miles from where I live, at Merrimack College, when the ABA camp was around. And he would go there. And it was an overnight camp for kids. All the kids would stay there for free, and all the poor kids in Lawrence, and kids would come down from the North Shore, Salem, and places like that. And Bert Hamill, the late coach of Merrimack College, used to provide sustenance and food and drinks for these kids for free. And Jalen Brunson went to that camp for several years, as did Michael Carter Williams of Hamilton, who became the Rookie of the Year back in 2012-2013. He also went to that camp when he was 6 or 7 years old. So when I think back of those days, seeing those kids, they were just average little kids. They might have had a little more skill than the other 8 or 9-year-olds, but there's no way that you dreamed they would end up in the NBA the way Michael Carter Williams did and the way Jalen Brunson did. But Jalen has always been close to his father. I do know that Rick Brunson drove him hard. He wasn't easy on him. There was no easy road to get to the college level and to the pro level because Rick really drove him hard. But Jalen had the type of personality. He could take it. He had a dream, and he was willing to work for it.
Great story. Great story. Thank you for that. All right, Mike, let's summarize what else you might see this week, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, obviously the Minnesota Timberwolves, no surprise there. They finished off the Phoenix Suns in Phoenix last night, 4-0. I think some people expected that to go 6 or 7 games because, you know, the Suns do have Kevin Durant and Devin Booker, who scored 49 last night. But Minnesota, a superior team. And Anthony Edwards, he's a weapon around the country that I don't know how many people know about him. But he scored like 32 points in the second half last night, wound up with 40, and they wiped out the Phoenix Suns, so they're done. The Denver Nuggets, up 3-1, going home for a 5th game, could polish off the Lakers, so I could see them advancing. OKC could win their series 4-0. So, yeah, it gets interesting now. But in the Eastern Conference, the series we have not mentioned is our boys from the Milwaukee Bucks, missing Giannis Antetokounmpo. They're missing him badly because now they're down 3-1, and they go back to Milwaukee, but I can see them getting beat by the Indiana Pacers. Indiana Pacers are averaging like something like 125 points a game, and no one else is doing that. They have a high-octane offense, Rick, and they could finish off our Bucks, and I hate to see that because, you know, again, a local product, Pat Connaughton out of St. John's Prep, coming off the bench and playing some good minutes, but they don't have enough to go around. There was one thing that happened in the Bucks game yesterday, which Indiana won. Now, they were already down 2 starters. Damian Lillard, all-star player, obviously, who could score 30, 35 a game. He was out injured. He was in street clothes. Giannis was still in street clothes. So the Bucks, you know, Doc Rivers had to makeshift lineup, and Bobby Portis, who's usually a good 6th man, started the game last night, and he got ejected after 7 minutes for an altercation on the floor. And I'm thinking, really, how dumb is that? And, you know, I have to use that word dumb because you're already missing 2 of your teammates to the starters, and you're a valuable piece of the puzzle now. Why would you get yourself ejected in an altercation, further decimating Doc Rivers' bench? It was just a crazy thing. Obviously, Bobby Portis wasn't thinking, and the Bucks certainly didn't have enough offense to keep up with Indiana Pacers the rest of the way.
I think that is a good lesson, I think, in life, because around here, you know, in Boston, the last 25 years or so, we've had such a great run of success for the pro teams, for fans to enjoy, and you rarely, on any of the teams, you rarely see any of the players on those championship teams hurt the team by doing something like that, by a knee-jerk reaction, by being ejected or by getting a ridiculous penalty, in whatever the case may be. And that, that points out, I think, also how intense and how high level of athleticism this thing is. And these are competitors. And, you know, it's just a great lesson, Mike, and you know, and I hope that the coaches get that across. And it's like sometimes you just have to swallow your ego.
Oh yeah, I think with the Patriots, obviously, all the time they went 9 Super Bowls in 1 6. You had the discipline on the field with Tom Brady. He wasn't going to let anybody mess up. And of course, on the bench with Bill Belichick. And by the way, how great was Belichick in analyzing the NFL draft?
Spot on.
I mean, what a brilliant mind, still keen, and it kind of makes me think all those people who think now, because the Patriots have had 2 or 3 down years, that it was all Brady winning the championships and not Belichick. It shows you how wrong they are, because Belichick is obviously way ahead of the curve still in the way he analyzes people, analyzes football players. So going back to your original point, though, obviously the discipline that Tom Brady had, the discipline that Belichick had off the field, and then going back to the Celtics championship with Doc Rivers having the discipline, Kevin Garnett, you know, you had all those guys. You need to go back to the Bird, Parrish era. They didn't let things get out of line. With this current Celtics team, I think they keep their cool because you have Drew Holiday, an experienced hand who's won a championship. You have Tatum and Brown, who've been around several years now. Porzingis, who's been around several years. Derek White. They're no-nonsense guys. They don't get, like you said, knee-jerk reactions if they get a hard foul or anything like that. So Mazzulla, Joe Mazzulla, doesn't have to worry about that too much. There's no overreaction. And, of course, the Red Sox had their run of championships, too, and without any problems. So, you know, you're right. The Bruins are the same thing. So, you know, that's why maybe – that's certainly one of the reasons why Boston's had so many championships in the major sports.
Yeah, and it's a good lesson, I think, for bringing it on down to the high school level.
Sure.
Is that you really, you got to have that discipline, and all you may get screwed by a call, who knows, but nevertheless, you got to think of the overall team, and if you're a good player, you need to be out there. So it's I can understand, especially in a collision sport. You know what? Basketball is a contact sport. It's not a non-contact. So how much do they allow? Oh, tell me about the officiating.
Yeah, you know, I think the officiating has been so inconsistent, and I can see why players get frustrated. But sometimes you may get frustrated at one end of the court, but you may get a call that you didn't deserve on the other end of the court. So it tends to even out. But I think officials in the modern NBA are letting a lot of offensive fouls go. I see Jaylen Brown do it, and Tatum, they know they can bowl over their guy close to the basket, and the officials let it go. So if you're going to get away with it, you keep doing it until the officials call you for an offensive foul. Embiid certainly got frustrated yesterday when he nailed Jalen Brunson with an elbow in the face or in the throat and didn't get called for it. So they're letting a lot go, and I think players get super frustrated, and that's when they have that knee-jerk reaction. But you have to sort of rein that in. You sort of have to rein that in and say, okay, I don't want to get tossed out of the game. I don't want to pick up a technical foul and give up a couple of points. So you just have to swallow it and take it and keep playing. That's the only way you're going to stay in the game.
I read a column recently. I think it was by Bob Ryan.
Yep.
And I think he mentioned Mendy Rudolph. And that just, that brought back memories. And what you just said about getting a non-call in one end and getting a call your way in the other end, I think of the famous the makeup calls. You remember those?
Yes. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And it was like justice, you know?
Yeah. You just never know the way the refs are going to call things these days. They seem to be letting a lot of things go, especially at the offensive end. It's like Eric Spoelstra. We talked about him being unpredictable and doing the unexpected. The officials these days, even when you and I watch a game on TV or you're at the Garden and watch a game, you think a call is going to go one way, and it doesn't go that way, and you're just left kind of shrugging your shoulders. Well, I think a lot of players shrug their shoulders these days because the officiating is so inconsistent.
But I
think in many respects they're doing the best they can.
And that's a real growth feature for the Celtics because this time last year and the year before, we were talking about Jason Tatum, complaining to the officials on everything and crying and sulking. And a couple of times, even in the playoffs, there have been stuff that he's right. There should have been a call. He does the shrug, and he may say something, but he stays involved.
Stays involved, and he moves on to the next play. I think I've seen it in the past year, Rick. I think you and I have probably both noticed that Jason Tatum does far less of the throwing his arms up in the air, frustrated with the calls on the non-calls. Sometimes he'll convert a basket, obviously. He feels like it should be an and one, get another free throw as well. But he just moves on to the defensive end and hopes that he gets the call next time he drives to the basket. So I do love the fact that he does take it to the basket often and gets a lot of free throws. And, he needs to keep doing that because I hate for the Celtics to resort to just being a three-point shooting team. I get frustrated with that. They took 49 of them in the first game, and they won big, but they shot poorly in the second game and lost. And the other night, there was a more concerted effort to get the ball inside with Porzingis and Tatum and Brown driving. And even Pritchard, the smallest guy in the court, how many times have we seen him this year drive the ball to the basket? He misses a shot. He gets a rebound on the offensive end, being the smallest guy on the court. He's a scrappy kid. He just reminds you of some of the really good players around the league that's been around, and they play taller than what they really are. He's a scrappy kid. He's got enough experience now. He's still a great shooter outside, but he's not afraid to pull up and take a foul line jump or take it all the way to the basket because, he's willing to put up with some punishment.
I think that's a great point. And it's fun to watch him, and I just hope that Mazzulla stays with his rotation. I think finally, Mike, I want to ask you about defense, because the defense we saw, I think, on Sunday was spectacular, to coin a phrase. It was tremendous.
Right.
And to your point, it was 48 minutes worth. Is that something that can be sustainable?
Why not? I mean, I think, holding Miami to 84, I think Al Horford, if anybody, he's so level-headed and he's so bright. He talks about this stuff all the time about playing an even game for 48 minutes, meaning like keep applying the defense, you know, even if it's not going well for a few minutes, because to hold Miami at 84 points, and they could be a really a great scoring team, it indicates that if they play, if they focus, you would use, if they focus on the defensive end, it takes a lot of effort to play good defense. It's tiring. It's exhausting. Sometimes players like to relax just for a second or two on defense because they want to save that energy for the offensive end. But you play the great defense, you cause a bad shot, you're going to get a better shot at the offensive end. So, you know, if they can stick with that focus, if they can stay focused on the defensive end, good things, beneficial things are going to happen against the Miami Heat. And they'll move on to the next series, which, you know, I cannot see the Celtics, you know, let's say, I don't want to assume they're going to beat Miami here because it's still only 2-1 as you and I are speaking. But if they could buy this series, to me, on paper, it looks easier in the next round against either Cleveland or Orlando.
Okay, we're going to
obviously, you know, the Knicks may be looming at the end of that, after that series.
All right, I want to get this posted, so we're going to wrap it up here in a second. But you mentioned one thing about taking a playoff. And that happens. It happens in all sports at all levels, and it's probably a necessary consequence of staying in a game and playing in a game. But it's funny. Remember the old isolation camera they used to have in football or whatever it was?
Yeah.
I focused on James Harden the other night. I just kept watching him. No matter where the ball was, I watched James Harden.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you know,
yeah,
he took time off on defense, but boy, you know, and I watched him and I thought, okay, he's not being lazy. He's just catching his breath, taking his time off, picking his moments on defense because he can see, you know, where the play is. And I started to think, oh, man, this guy's not as good as I thought he was. But then he just explodes in the other direction, you know, and it's smart basketball.
It is, because he's up there in age, Rick, right?
He's
being an older player. And I remember he was kind of overweight a year or so ago, and I thought that hurt his game. This year he seems to have slimmed down a bit. But, yeah, he's still productive. But, you know, when I watch that Dallas team, and I don't understand, people have actually mentioned Doncic in the MVP race, and by the grace of God, I have no idea where that comes from, because he is such a weak defensive player.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great offensive player. He puts up triple-doubles, but he's a one-way player, similar to Kyrie Irving. I think, if anything, Harden might even play better defense than Doncic or Kyrie Irving.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I get your point about Harden. But I see Kyrie play, and I see Doncic play, and I just don't get why people make so much of them, because they certainly don't put out on a defensive end, and they're front runners as well. They look good when the team is winning, and everybody wants to talk to them and all that stuff. But, you know, both of them leave a lot to be desired on the defensive side. And as long as both of them carry the load for the Dallas team, Dallas isn't going anywhere, in my opinion.
All right, well,
as good as some of the elite teams.
Let's hope the Celtics keep going. We'll do it again next week. That is our basketball insider, Mike Grenier, our sports journalist extraordinaire, and we appreciate the time. This is MSO News Sports, and I'm Rick Moore.